This is Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe. Patrick serves up the hardest-hitting podcast in tennis with news, politics, and insights you won't find anywhere else. Here's Patrick McEnroe.
All right, everyone. Time for another edition of Holding Court. And suffice to say that Pam Shriver has done all it takes to be able to get the technology up to speed. As you see, Pam, the great Pam Shriver, joining us from Mexico, where she's working with Donna Vekic at the tournament there. Pam, thank you for all your hard work to get up and running. We appreciate it. We've had you here before on Holding Court. And, you know, the fans demanded, back by popular demand, the one and only Pam Shriver. How are you?
I'm good, Patrick. It's great to be with you. And you always have to do some troubleshooting when you're in a different country, so it's all worked out. Thanks for your patience. If only had that, I had that much patience when I played tennis, I would have been better off.
You know, it's funny because I'm looking, you know, I always go over the stats a little bit, right, when I have a former player on, so we know all about your, is it, I think it's 21 majors, right, in doubles? Is it 21?
21 in ladies doubles and then one
and then
in
you
mixed.
One in mixed, right. And who is your partner, by the way, in the mix?
Emilio Sanchez, believe Emilio it or not, he's also a coach here this week in Monterey, so we've been reunited for a week.
But here's a little snippet that I pulled out of reminding myself of all your great numbers. You're a Hall of Famer, of course. Do you? I don't know if you know this. Do you know that you actually won more? Because everybody knows you as one of the great doubles players. People forget that you are number three in the world in singles. You won, not only did you win 21 titles in singles, you won more matches in singles than you did in doubles. Did you know that, Pam?
Well, I knew
I mean, that's according to Wikipedia. Okay, so I didn't go to the WTA stats.
Yeah, I knew I won over 600 in singles, and I know that's a lot.
Yes, it
and
is.
And singles draws are bigger, so it doesn't really surprise me, but I think I'm pretty close. The thing that freaked me out was when Martina retired for the first time. It was like she had won, I don't know, 167 titles in each singles and doubles, and that was something I couldn't believe.
Well, just for the record, I think it's 626 in singles and like 621 in doubles. Okay, so as I said, I bring it up because I want you to know and our fans to know that I do my homework, okay, and that you were an unbelievable singles player as well. But as I've told you before in when we were communicating back and forth, I'm very excited about season four because there's three main topics for the podcast series. Of course, tennis, what's going on currently in the world of tennis, so we could just talk about that in our sleep. Number two is this intersection of sports and politics, which you and I could also talk about with your background and history. But number three is mental health and mental well-being. And of course, mental health and tennis go hand in hand. So I feel like we can cover those two. And that's really why I wanted you to come on at this particular time. We can talk about women's tennis and the situation that's in there now. But you know, you released your article last year. You said it was because you were turning 60. You talked about the relationship that you had with your coach at the time when you were a teenager, and it was important for you to put it out there publicly now at this stage in your life, for you personally, but also for the state of women's tennis in general. So if you could expand on that as we lead into this, I would be very appreciative.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a really difficult thing to go public with. It took me a long time. I kind of just pushed it down. But basically, you know, from 17 until about 22 and a half, I had a relationship with my primary coach that crossed over all boundaries. It became what you would classify today in today's world as sexual abuse, abuse of power, because you know, if you're a student of a teacher or a coach or, you know, any position of trust and power, you really have to keep the boundaries firm. We know a lot more now than, say, back in the late 70s, early 80s. The language is different. But what I've observed in my decades on the tour is that there's still too many women players that either haven't quite figured out how to keep the boundaries or the people on their teams are very good at, you know, the grooming and the manipulating, and then the relationship ends up blurred lines, unhealthy, not good for really the coaching profession or any profession, say physio or anything, and it certainly isn't good for a female tennis player. That's not to say if you're old enough, mature enough, and you've known, you know, and you meet a coach, you know, in the workplace, these things happen, but we need better safeguarding. We need to work together on this. And I believe that safeguarding and keeping the workplace safe needs to be on the same pedestal as anti-doping and anti-corruption. And that's really my mission right now.
You know, it's interesting the way you phrase that, because it, what came to my mind was something you then addressed later in your comments, which was, you know, there could be a situation, right, where there's a female tennis player that, you know, they're in their mid, late 20s or they're 30, and they have a coach who could even be similar age or a little bit older or a lot older. And maybe that's, you know, because there are some female tennis players that actually married their, you know, what was their coach or their trainer. But it's as you said, finding that line of when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate. If you look at team sports, obviously, if there's a coach of the women's basketball team or the soccer team, it would be completely inappropriate, right? No matter what. But in tennis, because it's such an individual sport, it's sometimes harder to find that line, isn't it? And I mean, I think if you're talking about a teenager, that's pretty obvious, right? But it's particularly women's tennis now, they're like the men's game, they're playing longer, they're out there longer, they're more, you know, they're real adults at this stage. So how do you kind of navigate trying to find that balance and educating the players appropriately?
Well, I think education's right at the core of this whole thing. I think, you know, the earlier, and the education has to start well before a player hits the WTA tour. It really has to start at the ITF junior level. It has to start in cultures all over the world. But honestly, I actually believe that eventually I'd like the workplace to have certain protocols, you know, like in certain corporate worlds, if you start to date somebody within the same company, you can't report to them. They can't be in the same division. Sometimes they then move people out of different divisions. So there are ways to keep, you know, workplaces safe and healthy. How you do it on the tennis tour is something that some new people that have been brought on. There's a new director of safeguarding, Lindsay Brandon. She's just a couple of months in. She comes from a strong safeguarding background. So there's a few experts. There's a new person at the TIAI that's really looking at, that's looked at through the years, the anti-doping and the anti-corruption, but now they're also looking at safeguarding. So I'm trying to be a connector and to try and just get the dialogues moving and don't have all the answers yet. It is almost a year since I came out with my story, and I thought there'd be more progress, more people coming forward, but this is a slow slog, and I have patience, and I think we're going to make progress in the coming years.
Well, you should be commended, and you are being commended by me, certainly, for putting this out there and being willing to talk about it. So, Pam, you know, I like to think of myself as someone that's done a lot in the different areas of tennis, and then I look at you, and in many ways, you're someone I've always looked up to because you have done that from the start, you know, whether it's on the WTA tour, you were the first president of the USTA Foundation. I came in after you served there. So you've navigated so many different paths. And now it's so awesome for me to see you get into coaching, because I know that's something that you've talked about for a long time. There aren't enough female coaches, and, you know, we all know the reasons why. But we also know that the opportunities haven't always been there for whatever reason. And how has it been for you? Because obviously your player, Donna Vekic, who you've been working with since late last year and now beginning of 2023, has had great results. But what's it been like for you doing one of the only things in the sport that you never really did, which is become a coach on the tour?
Patrick, I'm so surprised. 4.5 months after going down to San Diego, I drove down from my home in LA when there was a San Diego Open, a 500 WTA event. I wasn't working as a broadcaster. My kids kind of had nothing much going on. So I just went down. I wanted to actually talk to some of the players on the player council about safeguarding, actually. That's why I drove down. Donna Vekic is on the player council. Pegula was down there. Grabowski was down there. So I kind of went down there with that as my main agenda. I also went down as a fan of women's tennis. I wanted to see some matches in person where I wasn't working. And so I contacted Donna. We met after her. She won her qualifying match. She was ranked about 75 in the world. And of course, like you and I, whenever we watch a tennis match, you kind of start to analyze. You start to look at it. You look at the tactics and you just look at things, right? So I actually, my first conversation before we got to safeguarding or anything, I said, you know, we talked about her match a little bit. I said, are you open to some input? She said, yes. And there you have it. That's how it all started. Yeah, and then she got the finals of San Diego. She wanted me to watch as many of her matches there, and I ended up flipping my week around. I didn't really have a lot going on, and I ended up watching her play, and she beat Sakkari, Pliskova, Sabalenka, and Danielle Collins to play Swiatek in the finals, and at a set apiece, I'm like, wow, this is some rookie accidental debut. And then she's been rolling ever since, and it's more about clarity of thought and some things that I learned from when I played, from things you learn as a broadcaster that are really important, and she's been a great listener. And it's been an unbelievable first experience for me. See your ranking go back from in such a short period of time from 75 to now 27 in the live rankings. So can't ask for more.
Amazing. I mean, that's an incredible start. And obviously you're enjoying it. She's enjoying it. And that's a recipe for success. So you know, when you talk overall, though, Pam, about what you see on the tour, I want to go back to the safeguarding and to the mental health. And obviously the big story and one of the big stories in women's tennis in the last couple of years has been Naomi Osaka, her willingness to put that story out there, which I thought was extremely courageous. Of course, we now know that she's out waiting for the birth of her child, and we wish her all the best and hope she can come back to the tennis courts. But so what you've seen just in the last couple of years, the COVID, the pandemic, how that affected people. Where do you see the state just overall of the mental health on the WTA tour of the players? Obviously, that's a general question, but you know, with your experience and your knowledge and now being sort of in the locker room a little bit more, what do you see?
Well, I see things totally out of the closet now as far as us as a sport, realizing it's really important. Patrick, you just mentioned all the many different factors. COVID was the most unusual, unique, hopefully once in our lifetime experience. And to go through it, and as a tennis player, as a young professional athlete trying to play a global sport with a shutdown, and then the way they were conducting press conferences and everything about tennis, except when you walked out on the court and you kept score and the lines were the same, but almost everything else for a while was totally different. That alone brings a lot of stress. The lifestyle, even in its normal, expected way, is a lot of stress. You're a young person going through all the growth of young people. So it's a recipe for having mental health issues, not to mention devices, social media. Like, you and I both have three teenagers. And my heart breaks for teenagers of this era because they haven't really had what we had, Patrick, which was, you know, a teenage life that wasn't full of the stressors of social media. So you put it all together and it's a perfect storm for a lot of people to struggle. So it's funny, when I first started to sit down today to record the podcast, I actually was in the mental health office. That was the quietest office for me to be in. So they have a mental health support person, even at a WTA 250. So there is a lot of resources being spent, but it, you know, and the player, again, they have to realize that they need the help and want the help. So I'm glad that it's out of the closet and it's being addressed.
Well, that's a great news. I mean, to me, that's great news that they actually have someone, excuse me, on site. So is that happening at all the WTA events now, where if a player is experiencing whatever issues they have, they can actually go to a professional? That's not part of their team per se. That's just part of what the WTA provides, just like they provide physios and massage therapists at all the locations. They now supply that as well.
Correct. So like when I started in 1978, the only support person was an athletic trainer. They weren't even a full physical therapist. And the upgrading and the in the whole health service world has been incredible on both tours. And I think the WTA is the leading sport for women globally. So why wouldn't they be the leading sport right, for bringing mental health on the road? They have a director of mental health. They now have a director of safeguarding. There's still a lot of work to do. And WTA still needs to just not rest for 1 second.
Well, clearly you're not. And women's tennis, or tennis in general, is better off because of that. All right, let's shift gears a little bit, Pam, to just what you saw. Obviously, you were down in Australia working with us at ESPN. You were on the ground there. You were working with Donna, who had a great tournament down there. Overall, give me your thoughts on what you saw on the women's side, and then also want to hear what you thought about what we saw from Novak Djokovic as well. So start just overall with how Donna did, which I know was a great run. And then, of course, what ended up happening with a great women's final in the championship match, Sabalenka winning that.
Well, for me personally, you know, my kid's dad, he's Australian, George Lazenby. My kids are all dual citizens, and part of the greatness for the trip for me was to bring my oldest son, who's now 18. He's not in school currently, so he was able to go down as an adult, as an Australian citizen, and see his other home country, and also to do some work. I know you guys had the tough end of the deal in Bristol, but to be able to be in person to help Donna for the first major of the year was important. I was happy ESPN allowed that to happen. So it was great to be down under. That was kind of where it all started 3 years ago when we heard whispers out of Wuhan. So it was great to be back. It was wonderful. And then obviously she had a terrific run to the quarters or second quarter final of a major ever and lost to Sabalenka. It's always nice if you're not going to win it to lose to the eventual champion. I thought Sabalenka's story where she came from, you know, a little over a year ago when she could hardly get a serve in the court. Someone who's worked so hard on every aspect to try and get the serve so that it's a weapon again. And the way that final against Rybakina was one of the great big hitting women's final in the history of tennis. It was a joy to watch. Rybakina almost won her second major in 12 months, and it would have been the first one with points. But I thought the Sabalenka redemption from the yips on the serve is really one of the great stories ever.
Absolutely. I mean, it was to see the way she was able to come back. And, you know, we were all saying in the Australian Open last year that, you know, she's going to need to take 3 months, 6 months off to just deal with this, because it obviously was so not only technical, but even more psychological at that point. And she worked through it. I mean, she was even competitive last year at the Australian Open. And of course, you know, kind of refound it. And boy, she was amazing under pressure. And look, you know, and we've seen it so often in women's tennis in the last 5-7 years, you know, trying to win that major, particularly when you've been as good as she's been. You know, she's been knocking on the door, and then you get that, you know, when is she going to win one? And then against a red-hot Rybakina who beats Swiatek and, you know, was awesome in the tournament. It was amazing. I mean, you talk about like well-earned and deserved. That was definitely that first major title for Sabalenka.
Yeah, and, you know, since someone like myself, I didn't get to win that first major. I'm always, in singles, I'm always cheering for that first major to happen. And I think Sabalenka really deserved it. Meanwhile, on the opposite end, you have Novak, who was marching towards tying Rafa. And what a bizarre set of circumstances for Novak to return to the place of such great trauma, back to Australia when he was deported last year, and that whole...
Oh, it's unbelievable. Before we get too yep. deep into that, I want to take a quick break, Pam, because you just reminded me of something. So we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back to Holding Court momentarily. We're going to talk about Djokovic and the men's game, and I have a little surprise for Ms. Shriver and for our listeners. So hold on. We'll be back on Holding Court. North Organic CBD is a new sponsor of Holding Court. I love their CBD gummies. They come in two delicious flavors, strawberry lemonade and green apple. I've had them both amazing. One a day and you're totally okay. I like to stay active. I like to keep playing tennis. I like to get in the gym. That's why I love North Organic CBD. Their products are made in the USA. They're high quality. They're specially formulated broad spectrum organic CBD products for everyday adventurers. Don't forget about the very popular CBD salve from North Organics. Immediate relief of any physical pain. I use it daily for my sore shoulders, sore knees, hips, you name it. It works wonders. Go to NorthOrganicCBD.com and enter Patrick20, that's Patrick20, for 20% off your order.
The Johnny Mack Tennis Project transforms young lives.
By removing the economic, racial, and social barriers to success through tennis.
JMTP provides tennis as a vehicle for greater life opportunity.
The programming provides a pathway to success through competitive tennis, leading to increased health and fitness, college scholarships, and incredible career opportunities.
JMTP introduces tennis to thousands of underserved New York children every week.
To date, the Johnny Mack Tennis Project has reached over 10,000 students through its community programs, providing 462 individual scholarships, totaling over $8.6 million, and 32 of its scholarship recipients have gone on to receive college scholarships through tennis. For more info, go to jmtpny.org.
I can't wait to hit the court after school.
All right, we're back. Patrick McEnroe here on Holding Court. Pam Shriver joining me from Mexico, where she's still working with Donna Vekic. And what a great start they've had to their partnership. But Pam, you started talking about Novak Djokovic in Australia, and I just cut her off briefly because she reminded me of something. And, of course, I was living vicarious through her, as we all were, up in Bristol, Connecticut, the home of ESPN, as we were broadcasting from there again this year. Now, Pam, as she mentioned, was down there working with Donna Vekic. Darren Cahill was down there working with Yannick Sinner. Renee Stubbs, also part of our ESPN crew. She was working with Sam Stosur. So you saw them commentating with us, doing courtside and being courtside for all the matches. But what many of you don't know is that last year, 2022, Pam was with us. Our entire team was in Bristol. I think Darren maybe and Renee were in Australia because they were coaching as well. So we had some time off in between. You know, we would start super late, and so we'd have maybe the whole day off and work through the night. And old Miss Shriver had some relatives in the area, I guess in upstate New York. And so she was taking excursions every other day or so at one point during the 2.5 weeks we're there. And she would bring back little gifts for all of us. And it became a really, really awesome event. We would wait for Pam. We'd have our meeting, and Pam would show up. So one day she was strolling around upstate New York, where I think it was one of your, was it like a nephew, was in school? Your nephew was in school. And Pam came across this place, and I'm holding up the shirt. It's McEnroe Organic Farm, and then it says on the back, support organic farming. Now, you might think, as many people do, that this is the the McEnroe, as in John, Patrick, Mark, Kay, John, you know, my whole family. It has nothing to do with the tennis McEnroes. Pam came across as not only brought me this shirt, McEnroe Organic, but also I think he brought, I have the hat too, which was amazing. But, you know, you're a sweetheart, Pam, is my point, because it was actually just very thoughtful and cool of you to do that. I think you brought a Chris Fowler, you found a sign that said, like an old sign shop, that didn't it say Fowler Street?
Yeah, Fowler Lane.
Like that. Fowler Lane, yeah. And what were some of the other gifts you brought back?
Well, we know Chris McKendry is a big Philadelphia sports fan, so I found like a 50-year-old Philadelphia Philly baseball card, and I don't know, just random stuff. I loved to go antiquing when I was younger, and it was in Amenia, New York, and then, you know, when I saw the McEnroe family, organic family farm, I nearly drove off the road, Patrick. And,
yeah. I've been there, by the way. I've been there a couple of times. It's a tremendous place. I mean, they sell those, you know, amazing pies and fresh honey and obviously all the organic fruits and veggies.
You know, Patrick, when you're up in the middle of the night and you're doing what we do, and I only did it for 2 years, you know, morale can get a little, you can get a little tired. So I was like, this is going to be really fun. So it worked out great. Thanks for remembering that I did that. And I hope to get back to the McEnroe Organic Family Farm.
I'm telling you, I mean, I love my shirt. I wear it all the time. And it freaks people out because they're like, I didn't know you guys had a farm. And I'm like, no, because you know, there's not that many McEnroes around. There's a town where in Ireland called Bally James Duff, Pam, which is in County Cork in Cavan, in a part of Ireland. And I was lucky enough to go there as a teenager, you may remember this, the U.S. Davis Cup team played a relegation match. This was in the early 80s against Ireland. And, both my brother and I actually could have played for Ireland. You know, we had the relatives. We had actually for quite a period of time, we actually had an Irish passport. So technically, based on, the way the rules are in tennis, we actually could have played for Ireland. So when the U.S. went to play Ireland, Arthur Ashe was a captain, and he invited he got John to play on the team, and he invited me, and he threw me a serious bone because I had just lost in the Kalamazoo final. You know who I lost to there, Pam? In the final, 18 and under boys championship.
Jonathan Stark? No, I don't know.
No, he's younger. Aaron Krickstein.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Who was younger, quite a year or two younger than me. I was actually 17 when I made the finals of Kalamazoo, which was an unbelievable result for me to make the final of the U.S. Championship. And I lost to Krickstein, who was younger. He got the wild card to go to the U.S. Open and had that great run, beat Vitas Garolaitis, got to the round of 16. And I'm like, oh, man, I lost my shot there. But anyway, Arthur, the captain would always invite the number one junior. And so he invited Krickstein, but because we were going back to Ireland and we have a lot of family back there, he invited me. So I got to go along as a hitting partner. We actually went to this town where half the town are named McEnroe. Okay, in this little town a couple hours from Dublin. So it was a very proud moment for my dad, who was his heritage of coming from Ireland. So he was super pumped about it. And the guy who played number one for Ireland was a former Californian. Do you remember Matt Doyle?
Yeah, I remember Matt Doyle.
Sean Sorensen was actually from Ireland. Like, he was a legit, player from Ireland. So he was their second guy. And anyway, so that was my Irish story. But yeah, that McEnroe Organic Farm is a great place. If you're ever upstate New York and you see it, go get something there. No proceeds coming to this McEnroe family, but God bless those other McEnroes. All right, so let's get to the men's tournament. You were talking about Novak, and I mean, the biggest thing to me going into the whole swing in Australia was how the crowd was going to receive him. It seemed to be extremely positive from, him winning the warm-up tournament in Adelaide, but being there, we still don't get the same feel as when we broadcast from Bristol. What was it like? I mean, what were the people on the street, the people at Melbourne Park saying about Djokovic being back and then, of course, going on the run where he, totally dominated the tournament?
Yeah, I think it was really – I think Novak felt very supported. I don't think anyone's ever gone back 12 months later. I mean, obviously there have been serious traumas in tennis. Just go no further than Monica Seles, what happened to her. That's the worst ever. But, this was a really difficult thing for everybody. Novak, the tournament, and obviously Novak brought it on himself by the choices he made surrounding the vaccine for COVID. But still, it was really messy a year ago. So to come back and kind of go back to the scene of all the embarrassment and being deported and being in that detention center and, being humiliated, brought back to the airport to leave under the threat that maybe he couldn't come back for 3 years. So we don't even know the amount of stress he was really feeling internally. And then he had the hamstring strain. So it was one of the most extraordinary runs to win a major, even though he's won. Can you help me remember? It's 21 now, right?
22.
22.
They're tied. He's tied with Rafa. He and Rafa have 22.
Right.
And Roger's retired with 20. How many does Serena
23.
Have?
23. She retired at 23.
No hesitation there.
Yeah, but I'm like telling that. You, getting all the numbers straight. I didn't do much homework going into this, but the point is,
you don't need to do homework for this.
I think this was the most special one for him, even though Australia's been like his, Rafa's version of Roland Garros. This was unbelievable, the mental strength, and that's what I've learned. Like, and I played with Martina. Martina left no stone unturned, and that's, she would look at everything from nutrition to, she looked at things that were 10, 15 years she was ahead of the game. I feel like Novak's the same way, and he's also extraordinary talent, but he just does everything Right. From data. He's got data coming in on how to play. He's got, you know, the right kind of recovery science that I don't think other of us will hear of in 5 years. You know, he's doing it all now.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think you're right about, you know, you look at the scores and, you know, he lost one set the entire tournament, was so dominant. But I think we saw his reaction, the emotional side, which I think you're spot on about. You know, obviously he had to deal with the slight injury early on in the tournament, which he navigated, which he's been the master at doing that. But the reaction after he won, you know, he still had that typical Novak thing, like, you know, I'm sticking it to everybody. I did, you know, but then when he went to his box, to his coach, his family that had been there. And by the way, remember his dad had the whole brouhaha with, you know, taking a picture with some guy with a Russian flag, the Putin flag. He wasn't even there the last couple of matches. So that had that had to not be that easy for Novak, just that, you know, had to deal with just yet another thing. But when he went up to his box and you saw the emotion come out of him, I think to me, that's when it hit me about how much, you know, it took out of him the entire trip down there. Forget about the tennis part.
Yeah, because look, any major for the 2 weeks, you keep so much of it. You just keep it contained, and you just go day to day to day. And then finally, when it's over, it all spills out. But there's nothing greater to spill out than Novak's 2023 Australian Open effort, given everything that he'd been through. And again, brought on by his own choices. Because one of the things I did hate was it was a little bit of gaslighting. It was a little bit of like, you know, Novak had nothing to do with this. He was just sort of like the victim, right? He wasn't the victim. He was like in charge of this. He decided to not trust the science, and he paid the consequences. But of course, you still take in the human side, trying to compete, trying to win a major, win seven matches. I mean, he was unbelievable. I will always remember that run to that title.
And it looks like he's still going to be paying some of those consequences, at least in the immediate future, because it doesn't appear that he's going to be allowed to come in for Indian Wells, the BNP Paribas Open, and, of course, the Miami Open, those events coming up. So let's look ahead a little bit, Pam, before I let you go, and I appreciate you figuring out how to get on from Mexico and do this while Donna is preparing for the rest of the tournament there. Swiatek, I mean, still looking good despite losing in Australia. Maybe not quite as dominant as she was. It'll be interesting, actually, how she does in this next 2 months, because that's when she really went on a tear, just dominating those two, the spring double. The sunshine double, as they now call it, and of course then on the clay. Do you see the same type of domination from her on the women's side? And then I want to hear what you think as well about the men.
Well, Swiatek seems to have a pattern where she go through a stage where she'll dominate. I mean, her scores are ridiculous. She'll go through like 12 sets in a row and no one will get past 6-3. A little bit reminiscent of some of the great champions of yesteryear. But then she'll like, you got to hand it to Krejcikova, who's figured out how to beat Swiatek twice in the finals in the last 6 months. Ostrava back in the fall in the Czech Republic, and then also more recently in the Middle East. And by the way, nobody watches more tennis in person than Krejcikova. So take that as a lesson for junior players and everybody around the world. I think you've got Rybakina, you've got Sabalenka, Krejcikova is starting to come back. If we can get one or two more of the women who've won one major and then kind of backed away, if they can kind of rise the way Krejcikova has, women's tennis can suddenly get really competitive again. I think going into the French, Swiatek's going to be the heavy favorite on her favorite surface. But I think I can see it's not going to be as one-sided, but Swiatek's definitely the dominant number one, and somebody's got to try and chase her down. And I feel like a few are starting to show the chops to do it.
Well, two things I want to respond to about that. Number one is you're 100% right. Fans that are not hardcore tennis fans want to see players that win multiple majors, right? So whether it's an Ostapenko or a Krejcikova, you know, even on the men's side, you know, teams disappear since he won his. Medvedev hasn't been the same, though. He's starting to come back a little bit. They want to see players that have done it, you know, not just once, but multiple times. So we'll see what happens on the women's side there. Here's what I want to ask you about the women. How, you didn't mention any Americans. So there's Coco Gauff, there's Jess Pegula, who's obviously right there at the top. You got Collins, you've got Anisimova. Just give me sort of an overview of where you see the American women as a whole at the moment.
Well, I think the two you mentioned first, Pegula and Gauff, lead the way. Huge credit to Pegula in every way to figure out how to get three in the world. She's got incredible ball striking, but she doesn't on face value. When you watch her play, you're like, how did she get to three in the world? And then you watch her week in, week out, her professionalism. And also, I loved what she wrote, you know, her own essay about her own journey and the struggles that her mom had, such a serious health issue. So she's been doing all this with a major family health issue going on with her mom and playing doubles with Coco Gauff. So one of the best, it's a throwback. She actually entered all three events in Australia. She lost early in mixed, which probably helped. I give a huge amount of credit to Pegula. Also comes from a family of great wealth, but she works hard. You wouldn't know it. Coco Gauff, you know, I heard you and Mary Jo on your podcast not that long ago discuss, she knows obviously golf a lot more than I do. I think we're all concerned about whether the forehand's just going to be never quite good enough. That, you know, because to get to the top with a forehand that breaks down is not that easy. It's happened before. Sanchez Vicario got to number one, but it's not that easy. So she's got to figure out how that shot's going to stand up under pressure. I feel like the serve's gotten a lot better. So Coco Gauff, I love everything about her. It's just that one question I have on the forehand side, which is crucial, as you know.
And any of those other names stand out for you? Collins, Anisimova, Alicia Parks had a big tournament win. You know, the veterans, Keys and Stevens. Anybody in that realm, or somebody that I didn't mention that's another youngster coming up that you think they can make a breakthrough and be, you know, a top? Because I'd say Gauff and Pegula. I mean, Pegula's already there, but they're certainly top five type players. Anyone else you see in that category?
Not right now. I mean, I think they can all be good. Collins has struggled physically. She's not where she was a year ago. Parks has had a tremendous run, but she's kind of struggled living with a seed by her name the last couple of tournaments. I always want to eyeball how does somebody handle the pressure once they've had their run, whether it's winning a major or winning a regular tour event. And that's where people have fallen down. And maybe that's how they can go get some mental health training as well, is how to live with the fact that you're the last one standing for a week. And that's what you want. You're not afraid of it. You got to embrace it.
Well, some of the male players might need some help in the mental department. I say that slightly tongue in cheek, of course, taking seriously the real mental health issues, but the issue of knocking on the door, right? When you've got Novak, you know, obviously Rafa's a question mark at the moment with his health, but you know, I'm talking about the Tsitsipas's. Sinner, who's on, you know, on his way up. He's got Darren Cahill in his side. Rublev, Medvedev's 1-1, but can he get back? So when you look at where the men's game is it just Novak and everybody else at this point? As we look ahead to these next two hardcore tournaments, he won't be able to play likely. And then, of course, most importantly, to the clay court season and to the French, and then Wimbledon, where to me, Novak is a huge favorite.
Right. Well, I think the biggest question on the men's side is going to be, will Rafa be good enough to have a clay court preparation, and can he win 15 at Roland Garros? Everything else is, you know, to me, Novak's really at the best. I mean, great to see Alcaraz come back, win Buenos Aires, get to the finals of Rio, but now he suffered another little injury. I feel like that was too much too soon for a 19-year-old who's come off an injury. So you got to make smart decisions everywhere. But listen, I played in the era of Martina, Chrissy, Gauff, where it became mental because they were winning all the majors. So it's a similar thing now. But you had Alcaraz breakthrough, and there will be more opportunities. But who's mentally big enough and doesn't have baggage that they're going to like be afraid of the moment? I mean, I can't wait to see those moments. You know, a semifinal and a final of a major with a new guy trying to win it. I mean, Wimbledon last year with Kyrgios in it was fascinating. Right. So I think we're going to have some of those surprises this year, and we'll just see how they handle it. But Novak's the guy to beat.
Yeah, well, you got that right. And you also got a lot of other things right. And I'm going to ask you one more thing before I let you go, because I asked you about the American women. How about the American men? You know, we've been getting some tough tough times, tough roads, criticism. I put myself because I feel like, you know, I root for the American guys the same way we root for the women. So it was an amazing tournament down there, you know, with Shelton, with Tommy Paul. Who am I missing? Michael Moe, J.J.
Korda.
Wolf.
Korda.
Yep. You know, who do you like the most? Don't forget our buddy Francis Tiafo from your neck of the woods, who's still playing extremely well. What's your take? And you know, who's got the best shot out of those guys to be a major winner, or let's say a major finalist at this point? How about just that? Because Fritz has gotten to a semi, so has Tiafo. How about getting to the final of a major? I'm not going to say winning it yet.
First off, did Taylor Fritz get to the semi? I know he lost to Rafa.
Semi's a Wimbledon. Was that the quarters? You're right. It was the quarters. I apologize. Yeah, you're right.
That's okay. So, but we had two in a row, and that was a huge breakthrough for U.S. because can you believe it? 20-year anniversary of Andy Roddick winning the U.S. Open is right now. It's 2023. I never would have imagined when I was growing up and when I played the tour that it would be a 20-year gap between U.S. man even getting to a final, as you said. I think any of those guys you mentioned could conceivably. I'd give the best chance to Taylor Fritz to get to a final. Okay. I would give Francis I think he loved what happened at the Open. He tasted it. He wasn't scared of it. He just has to still keep the maturing going along and being that full-on professional. You know, 52 weeks of the year, even if he's taking a week off from tennis. But I love the talent. They're all pushing each other. What Tommy Paul did at the Australian, fantastic. To taste the final four should just make you hungrier. And then the whole group pushes each other. We've seen that phenomenon in other countries, at academies. So they're pushing each other, and I think it's a great – I think they're going to break through in the next 12 months.
You know, I hope you're right. It was a fun Australian Open to watch them do so well. Got a lot of buzz back here. You, Pam Shriver, always get a lot of buzz, and I thank you. And please thank our friends at the WTA and in the tournament in Monterey for helping you out. I like the backdrop. I got my new holding court backdrop here, and we got the nice one there at the tournament there in Mexico. Good luck. While we're talking, she's in the middle of the tournament there, Donna Vekic. So good luck the rest of the way, Pam. And I very much appreciate, and so do my fans, having you back on Holding Court.
Thanks for having me, Patrick.
One and only Pam Shriver, Hall of Famer, here on Holding Court. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to and share Holding Court.
Holding Court is powered by Mudhouse Media.